Hello and welcome to this collaboration between the Penn Innovators in Business series and the Zoom Memes for Self-Quarantines page. In this series, we bring leaders and innovators from different fields to share their advice and experiences with undergraduate students to provide inspiration and motivation during the pandemic. We are so happy to have with us Mr. Jim Rogers. Jim is a millionaire investor, writer, and former co-founder of the Quantum Fund. Full interview is dedicated to the Helen Keller International, an NGO providing critical nutrition to children around the world at risk for vitamin A deficiency, a condition that can lead to blindness and death. Learn more and donate to the link in the description. Jim, you led a hedge fund, you traveled across the world, you beat the Guinness World Records, and this all started with a young boy growing up in Alabama. How did he first even know about applying for Yale?
By the way, for what it's worth, Helen Keller was from Alabama too. She spent her youth there, and then she went to Harvard. So I grew up in the backwoods of Alabama. I was not as smart as Helen Keller, but I did go to Yale and other places. It was all an accident. I knew nothing about Yale. I only applied to two universities, one of which was Yale, by chance. And lo and behold, I got in. I got a scholarship. So off I went. I was in over my head, though. I realized I made a mistake when they took me.
Could you tell us more about in what way was...
I grew up in the backwoods of Alabama. There were 40 people in my high school class, the whole town. It was a tiny town. My phone number was 5, Chris, where I grew up. It's not a typo. My phone number was 515. I got to New Haven. I didn't know anything about the North. I knew very little about the world. I certainly was not prepared. Well, there were guys there who'd gone to fancy prep schools, who'd read all kind of books and traveled, etc. In my town, if you read one book a year, you were ahead of most people. But since when I left the little town, I bragged and said, I'm going to Yale. I couldn't fail. I was scared to death, so I had to work very hard. I couldn't go back and say I didn't make it. I failed, so I had to work very hard. I was very scared, and I worked very hard. I had a wonderful time at Yale, by the way. And then at my next school, too, I had a wonderful time at both universities. But boy, was I in over my head.
And that next school is Oxford. Could you tell us what differentiated your time there with most of the students? I know you were working for your entire Yale career and also at Oxford, too.
Oxford is one of the things that I have told my children, for instance, is I don't care where you go to university as long as you go far away from home. For me, the best part of my education was going far away from home, finding people who did not think anywhere what I had been exposed to, didn't live the way I did, etc. So for me, the best part of education was going far away. Yale was couple of thousand kilometers from where I live, and of course Oxford was a few more thousand kilometers away. So that was the best part of the education. I had a wonderful time at both places. I had fun. I learned. I hope I learned a lot. But Oxford was a different country. And whenever you go to a different country, there was a guy once named Rudyard Kipling, who was an English poet. He actually won the Nobel Prize for Literature once. And he wrote a poem called The English Flag. In that poem, there's a line which says, "What can he know of England who only England knows?" In other words, you will know a lot more about England if you leave England and go other places. It will help you. It will teach you a lot about your own country, and it will teach you a lot about yourself. So it's very good for everybody to go to foreign countries. You can always go back, but you will learn a lot about your own country and yourself if you visit other countries.
I completely agree. I lived half of my life in China and half my life here. So that transition between one country to the other just brings into spotlight a lot of the differentiations and different things about what you know, about what you took for granted. And it's entirely different in another country. We'll talk about how many countries you've been to, which is incredible. But there's one story in Oxford. I read your book, The Investment Biker, and you talked about there was this moral dilemma between a dream of yours and doing the right thing. Could you expand upon that more?
Well, I've had lots of moral dilemmas in my life.
It's specifically on the rowing team.
I presume you're talking about when I was trying to be there's something called the Oxford and Cambridge boat race. And I wanted to be in the Oxford and Cambridge boat race, and I was trying out. And then suddenly my family got a letter from the coach saying, if a lot of money shows up in my bank account, your son will make it into the boat. My father, of course, had no clue what this was all about, and he sent me the letter. And I, of course, was, what do I do now? What's going on here? What is this all about? First of all, it's my first few months abroad, which is one thing. Second, I'm at this Oxford University trying out for this famous race. But what do I do? Well, in the end, I went to the coach and said, I resign. I'm not going to do anymore. And he said, why? He knew something was wrong. And I showed him the letter, and the coach is no longer the coach. I stayed, continued to try out, and eventually I got into the boat the next year, not that year. And I'm the first person from Demopolis, Alabama, to be in the Oxford-Cambridge boat race.
Wow. And during that period of time, did you ever think take on the other path? And throughout your life, many of these decisions have happened. Why don't you take on the other path?
Well, you mean by the other path to put money in the guy's bank account? First of all, whatever he would have wanted, my family certainly didn't have that kind of money to be robbing me into the boat race. It was certainly not something we ever thought about, because if you do something like that, first of all, it's not ethical. It's a moral dilemma, as you point out. But the second result often is it winds up being worse than what you thought. I mean, you might get caught, which ruins you. No, there are many reasons not to do it, including the ethical decision, many reasons, practical and ethical, not to do it. So it never came up that we might do something like that.
I wanted to ask this because in investing, I think there's always this dilemma in everything as well. And you retired from investing, or you retired at 37 to travel the world. But in your journey during investing, these problems did emerge as well. So how do you want to recommend students who are going into investing or finance to try to navigate and try to these issues?
I cannot teach anyone ethics. I cannot teach anyone morality. You learn that from your parents. If you haven't learned it by the time you go to university or go to work, you're probably not going to learn it except the hard way. But I have certainly learned that the right way is always the best way for many reasons. One, it's easier to sleep at night. It's easier not to have to cover up something. And as I said before, if you do get caught, the consequences can be very drastic. I can remember once I was on 60 Minutes, and the guy said, we were talking about a guy who'd broken the law and gone to jail in investing. And they said, what would you tell him? And I would say, why didn't you do it the right way? You're a very smart guy. Very smart guy. And if you'd done it the right way, I'm sure you would have as much money or nearly as much money, and you wouldn't have a problem. And I would say that to most people. Do it the right way, because I'm sure you're plenty smart. And cutting corners and doing it the wrong way, for the moral arguments, but also just the practical arguments, if you do get caught or whatever, even if you don't get caught, you spend your whole life covering up, and that can be a problem. And usually, many of these people are plenty smart, but for some reason, they take the wrong way and they wind up suffering. Most of them would make just as much or plenty of money doing it the right way instead of doing it the wrong way.
And talking about the right way, from 1970 to 1980, you co-founded the Quantum Fund. And during this period, you beat the S&P by almost 4,200%. So what is this right way exactly? How do you beat the S&P 4,200%?
It so happened, we both loved what we were doing. For me, it was just an insatiable passion, the markets and knowing what, finding out what was going on in the world. For me, I couldn't believe how much fun it was. My partner also loved the markets. And so I spent lots of time and energy researching, investing, and looking for things to invest in. It was a very bad time in the world financial markets, very bad if you look at the 70s. But I guess that must have also given us opportunities, because since things were so bad, the more you looked, the more you might find something. And we found lots of things.
Interesting. And could you just share one example of how you thought about investments? What is your thought process of going into a company or a commodity or a country and seeing why you want to invest in it?
Everybody, usually if you're successful at anything, you find your own way. You don't listen to other people. At first I listened to other people. I thought, oh gosh, they're smarter, they're educated, they have more experience, they must know what they're doing. Then I realized after a while they didn't know what they were doing either. So to learn, my way was mainly to find things that were cheap. And if they're cheap, they're usually ignored, obviously, where there was change taking place. If you could find something that was very cheap and ignored, where positive change is taking place, and you're right about the positive change, you will usually make a lot of money. And that was one of the main things that I did and we did. On the other side, if you can find something that's wildly popular, it's usually very expensive. But if you can find something that's very expensive where there's change taking place, negative change, you can sell it short, and usually you can make money protecting yourself when something collapses. So that's what we did. For me, people said things like when they heard about us, oh, you're a contrarian. No, I was, yeah. If you buy something that's ignored, of course, you're going contrary to what other people are doing. But that was not the point. The point was just to find something cheap where there was change taking place.
I know today's market is very volatile and very expensive. But do you see this is a viable strategy now to find something that's ignored?
It will always be a viable strategy. There's always something cheap. It doesn't have to be a stock. It could be a company or a country. It could be an industry. Right now, for instance, Russia is hated and Russia is very cheap. Russia's for over 40, 45, 60, 50 years, I was negative on Russia, very negative on the Soviet Union and then on Russia. But partly everybody else was too, and it's very cheap. And a few years ago, I thought I saw change taking place in Russia. And so I'm optimistic about Russia now. They have vast resources, not much debt. It may be a great opportunity.
Interesting. And talking about Russia, you traveled to Russia right after you retired at 37 years old. So just as a little background, you first motorcycled across a series of countries, getting the World Guinness Book of Records. And then a few years later, you drove across all these countries again. Could you talk a little bit about what you learned and how do you understand a country from the inside?
Well, Chris, first I would tell you, I'm in the Guinness Book of Records 3 times, which is great. My mother loved it, but it doesn't pay the rent. I assure you, it's nice to be able to say, but that's about all it's good for. Yes, I first went to the Soviet Union actually when I was a student at Oxford. And I came away saying, this will never work. It cannot work. It's going to be a disaster. And that's why I was negative for a long time. I wanted to drive around the world on my motorcycle. But in those days, it was crazy to drive across the Soviet Union, crazy to drive across China. These were the days of the Cold War and communism and Red China. But I finally got permission to do both, and I did. When I drove across China, I realized that China was changing dramatically for the better, but I also realized that the Soviet Union and Russia were still a disaster and going to be a disaster for a long time. But as I said before, a few years ago, I realized something's changing in the Kremlin, and so now it might be a great opportunity. But for many years, the Soviet Union, Russia, I went to most of the countries. I think I probably went to nearly all the countries. Boy, what a mess. Communism ruined a lot of things, including the Soviet Union.
And going back to that, why a motorcycle?
Motorcycles are a lot of fun, at least for me. And people who have motorcycles, many of them will tell you it's a lot of fun. I actually had a guy, a friend of mine on Wall Street, and I used to ride motorcycles. He used to laugh at it, et cetera. Then one day he was about 55 years old, 50 years old or something. And he came to me and said, "Oh my God, I have a motorcycle and I love it. How did you know? Why didn't you tell me?" I said, "What? Oscar, for years you told me I was an idiot. I was a fool for riding a motorcycle. And now he's a crazy guy riding motorcycles everywhere." So they're a lot of fun if you try it and if you like it. They have a bad image sometimes, but it's a lot of fun to ride a motorcycle, at least for me.
But just imagining the scene of you riding a motorcycle across the Soviet Union or China, you're a foreign guy. Like, how did people react to this?
Especially in China, because China had, or both, but especially China, because I was Caucasian and obviously stood out. Everywhere I went, I stood out dramatically because I was a Caucasian on a motorcycle, and they'd never seen motorcycles like that, much less foreigners, much less Caucasians, and much less American. Oh my goodness, nobody could conceive of that. Same sort of thing happened in the Soviet Union. It was not quite as dramatic because they're mainly Caucasians too. But they'd never seen motorcycles like that. They'd never seen Americans. We always parked the motorcycle and tried to find a safe place. And we often went to the police station to park our motorcycles. And I remember one night in Siberia, there was a TV crew there, and the woman was interviewing me. And then I could see there was a question she wanted to ask. And finally she said, because we were Americans, and she said, "Are you a capitalist?" She'd never seen a capitalist. She'd always heard about what evil, horrible people capitalists were. And I looked up in great surprise. Yeah, I'm a capitalist. Straight out, flat out capitalist. She was terrified.
I see. That's so interesting. And
like if somebody showed up in Iowa long ago from Russia and said, I'm sure the people would say, "Are you a communist?" So she'd been full of Russian propaganda all her life, just like I'd always been full of propaganda all my life.
I see. And just to stay on this topic a little bit further, China, U.S. and Russia, U.S. relations are in a very different situation now than it was at that point. What do you see for the future of China, U.S.?
China and U.S. are the largest economies in the world, and there's a lot going on for both. And they have worked together well for the past few decades until recently. This year, both the Republicans and the Democrats have said we're going to win the election by bashing China. And that to me is insane. China and America should work together, could work together to continue to bring great prosperity for both. Unfortunately, when things go wrong throughout history, countries have always blamed foreigners. It's easy to blame foreigners, whoever the country is, because they have different skin, different language, different food, different religions. They smell bad. I cannot tell you how many times people tell me foreigners smell, and their food smells bad. Oh my goodness. Their food smells bad. I've heard that so many times about foreigners when people, it's very easy, and politicians love to exploit that the foreigners are evil. And that's happening now. Unfortunately, it's going to get worse because there is an election. And then after the election, I'm sure there will be an aftermath. I just hope that somebody comes to their senses and realizes that, hey, guys, let's all get very prosperous together. Let's work together instead of bashing each other. Trade wars and bashing foreigners has never been good for anybody, and closing off has never been good for anybody. Unfortunately, Chris, probably the main lesson of history, one of the main things I have learned from history is nobody learns the lessons of history. History teaches us that trade wars are bad, but nobody learns that. In Washington, they all, if they know the lessons of history, they think history is bunk. They think they're smarter than history. They think that since they're smarter than history, they can win a trade war. As I said, most people don't learn the lessons of history.
And you were a history major in Yale, correct?
Yes, I was, yes.
Is there anything else inside our current world's affairs that you see parallels in history?
Oh, many things. Mark Twain, great American writer, said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And he's right. That's what I was saying, that we should learn the lessons of this. One of the things, right now, there are a few countries collapsing. Venezuela, Zimbabwe, there are always some countries in catastrophe. But I have learned that if you get involved in a country that's collapsing and in catastrophe, usually 5 or 10 years later, you're very successful and very prosperous. It's illegal for me to invest in Venezuela. I would like to. I'm an American, so I cannot. But there are great opportunities usually when places collapse. History shows us that. Very few countries disappear from North Korea when after North Korea disappeared for decades and it still disappeared. But even North Korea is now going through huge change. It's been decades. If you'd invested in North Korea in 1955, what I just told you would not have taken place. But maybe if you invest in North Korea now, you might find great prosperity.
Interesting. And actually, you've mentioned North Korea a few times in other interviews as well. What do you see in North Korea that's similar to other countries?
North Korea has been a communism ruin. As recently as 1970, North Korea was richer than South Korea, had great natural resources, etc. But, Christopher, the Kims and communism can ruin anything. So you had the worst combination. You have communism and the Kims. So they've totally destroyed North Korea. But the guy running North Korea now is young. I call him the kid. He's not really North Korean. He grew up in Switzerland. Now, Christian, would you rather live in Switzerland or North Korea? I know your answer, of course. And so would he. But he cannot go back. His father made him the leader, so he's stuck in North Korea. So what he's trying to do is to make North Korea like Switzerland. There's international ski resort, free trade zones, all sorts of things. International bicycle tours, international marathons. He's trying to change North Korea. It takes a while, but it's going to happen. And once the 38th parallel opens between North and South Korea, the Korean Peninsula is going to be an extremely exciting place to be.
I see.
But again, I cannot do anything in North Korea because I'm a citizen of the land of the free, and we're not so free sometimes.
I was just going to mention, these are all investments that we can't actually invest in, but is there something that you would recommend the younger generation, like the college students, to invest in now?
If you're an American citizen, you cannot do anything in North Korea or Venezuela. You can do something in Zimbabwe if you want to, or other countries which have collapsed. One of the things I said before, and if I were a college kid, I wish I had learned it earlier, but as a student of history, I did learn it eventually, that if you find catastrophe, whether it's an industry, a company, a country, you should investigate, because often catastrophes, nearly always catastrophes, turn around. And a few years later, you look like a genius because you were smart enough to invest in the catastrophe. Now, you have to be sure you're right, and you have to be sure you get your timing right. I told you, if you'd invested in the catastrophe of North Korea in 1955, you probably would have died poor because it is taking so long. But if you do your research, anybody, college student or not, it's a lesson to learn early. When you read the headlines of the newspaper or the internet or the TV about horrible disaster somewhere, you can say, oh my God, that's terrible. But you can also say, wait a minute, maybe it's going to lead to opportunities. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Asian languages, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, in Chinese, the word is weiji, and it means catastrophe and opportunity are the same thing. In Japanese, the word is kiki. It's interesting. It's the same symbol, the same character in all the languages, because they got their language from Chinese originally, hundreds of years ago. It's the same character, and it means the same thing. Catastrophe and opportunity are the same thing. I wish I had learned. I did eventually learn it. I learned it fairly early. But it's a good thing that we should all learn very early, and Asian civilizations have been around a lot longer than we have, so learn it now.
Yes, I think the next question I had was, in your life, if you could create two people who are your board members, your advisors, and listen to their advice, who would those two people be?
Oh, that's a very good question. The first one that comes to mind is Deng Xiaoping, the guy who changed China in 1978. Deng Xiaoping said, "We got to try something new." And he was an ally of Mao Zedong, but he said, "This does not work. We got to try something new." And he opened China, and he probably the most influential, certainly person of the past 50 or 100 years, because he took China from being red Chinese, communist China, to an open and vibrant nation, society, and economy. Still problems, of course. Don't think I'm that naive. But Deng Xiaoping was, in the past, the Nobel Prize for Economics started in 1969. Nobody from Asia has ever won, including Deng Xiaoping, who's been much more influential than every. So I'd have to think about the other one, but Deng Xiaoping, far and away, he had a lot of genius, insight, vision, etc.
Yes, amazing. And then we'll start the Q&A section. These are some of the questions from students and from people who are listening. This is one question by Jason Kim. In the past, you have warned that cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin are risky, and that, quote, "If the cryptocurrency succeeds as real money, the government will make the cryptocurrency illegal and eliminate it." And recently, we have seen parties such as the Chinese government releasing eYuan and JPM launching JPM coin. What is your advice and thoughts on the legitimacy of cryptocurrency today?
First, money is going to be on the computer. It's already starting. In China, you can't even take a taxi with money. You have to have your money on your phone. I couldn't even buy an ice cream in China with money. So I got my money on my phone. So the world is changing. China's way ahead of the US and other countries with putting money on the phone, but it's going to happen. In the US government is starting to experiment and develop its own money on the computer. Everybody is. Governments love money on the computer. It's cheaper than having, they don't have to print it, they don't have to transport it, they don't have to protect it, they don't have security problems. The government, and the main thing, Chris, is they love, because they will know everything you do. They're going to call you up one day and say, "Chris, you've had too much tea this month. Stop drinking." They'll know everything you do. And they love that. I, of course, hate it. It's not good for us, but it's certainly good for them. So money is going to be on the computer. Now, the crypto guys said, "Well, we're smarter than the government." And of course they are. Nearly everybody's smarter than the government. But the government has the guns. And if it's successful, the governments are going to say, "You cannot use somebody else's money. You can use computer money, crypto money, but it has to be ours." Because they're not going to give up control. They're not going to give up power. 100 years ago, we could use anything we wanted as money. We could use seashells or gold. Banks could print their own money, legally print their own money, and people used it. But then in the 1930s, the Bank of England, which was the most important bank at the time, said, "From now on, if you use anything for money except our money, it's an act of treason." Well, Chris, treason means they execute you. So most people stop using other forms of money except legitimate government money. And that will happen again if this stuff is successful. That does not mean it's not a great trading vehicle. If you're a good trader, by all means, do it. But I'm just alerting you that history would show that if it's successful, it's going to disappear.
But do you think, like the question says, the Chinese government has created eYuan? Do you think a government that currency would be more, cryptocurrency would be more beneficial?
Do I think money on the computer? Yes, as I said, it's good for everybody, especially the governments. It doesn't matter what I think. They've got the guns. And if they say you have to use computer money, crypto money, call it what you will, yes, it's certainly a lot easier. I know Chinese who don't even have wallets, who don't have purses. Any young Chinese don't know what a wallet is. They don't need it. Everything they have, their identification, their money, everything, addresses, friends, everything they need is on their phone. So there are many Chinese who don't even know what a purse is, much less what a wallet is. And that's going to happen. Is it good or bad? It doesn't matter what I think. it's what is going to happen.
I see. The next question is, what is one lesson that you use every day that you've learned throughout your life?
Brush your teeth every morning.
Okay.
Your mother was right. You should brush your teeth at least twice a day. In the big picture, I guess the main thing is, and I try to teach my daughters this, think independently and be skeptical. It's very hard. It's very hard to think independently and be skeptical. But I try to teach them, including me, that whenever I see something, I immediately say, well, okay, let's figure out what's really going on here. Because the headlines and the press and the internet, somebody has an axe to grind. Somebody's trying to say something. Somebody's trying to do something. I have learned, and I'm trying to teach my daughters, try to figure out what's really going on. Because what the headline says is not the complete reality. And if you can figure that out, always you'll be way ahead of the game.
And talking about your daughters, they're fluent in Chinese and they have a YouTube channel. What was the rationale of bringing them to Singapore to study and to learn?
For many, after I drove across China a few times on my motorcycle, et cetera, I realized that China was rising, going to be the next great country in the world. It's the only country in history that's had recurring periods of greatness. Rome was great once, Great Britain was great once, Egypt was great once, but China's been great three or four times. They've had total collapse three or four times, but they're the only country that after being on the bottom for decades or centuries has turned around and risen. They're doing it again. I could see that happening, so I wanted my children to prepare them for the 21st century, and I wanted them to know Asia, and I wanted them to know Mandarin, the language. Is not going to make them successful, but at least they will have a leg up. If they work in a Chinese restaurant, they'll be the maitre d', they won't be the dishwasher. Well, it's not going to make them successful, but I wanted to prepare them for the 21st century. Who knows how it will work out, but it will give them an advantage that most other people do not have, being fluent in Mandarin and fluent in English and knowing Asia.
I see. And the final question is, what is your advice for students? If you are our age, what will you be doing?
The main thing, and students frequently ask me, what to study? And I will tell you, the main thing that influenced me as a university student was history and philosophy. I tell people that at universities, they don't know, we want to be rich. How do we get rich? And I say to them, well, you study history, and you will learn a lot about the world and how it's always changing. And if you study philosophy, it will help you learn to think. I was not very good at philosophy in university, but later I said, oh, now I understand what they were trying to teach me. It will help you learn to think, which is difficult and important. But you should not listen to me or anybody else as what to study. My main advice to you is figure out your own passion. Figure out what you love the most, and that's what you should study, and that's what you should pursue. And if people laugh at you, you're really probably doing the right thing. So figure out your own passion, what you just love, and that's what you should study, and that's what you should pursue as a career as well.
Just one last question on that. When you own the Quantum Fund, what did you look for when applicants applied? What were you looking for in the students?
In those days, since they were usually assistant, I was looking for somebody who was good at who paid attention to detail, who would get things right. If I said, is the sky blue? I wanted somebody who would go and look out the window and come back and say, yes, the sky is blue. It was green yesterday. It's going to be purple tomorrow. I wanted somebody who gave me accurate, precise information. That's what I needed in an assistant to help me and us make decisions. That was in those days. So be attentive to detail, get things right. That's your first step if you want to impress the boss.
I see. Thank you so much. And this is truly a pleasure.
Thank you, Christopher.
Thank you so much for listening. and make sure to check out more content and subscribe to our podcast.